and welcome to the Wired Podcast. I'm Renu Pundit.
And I'm Laura Minton.
And we are medical students at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. We wanted to do something about the fact that despite men and women graduating from medical school at near equivalent rates, only about a quarter of radiologists in the U.S. are women.
So, we created Wired, the Women in Radiology Education Interest Group. Our passion is to support, inspire, and empower women through outreach events, personalized mentorship by connecting residents and attendings to learners, and creating opportunities for hands-on training for pre-medical and medical students to close the gender gap within the specialty.
In the midst of a global pandemic, while everyone felt the burden of isolation, we created a podcast as a means to share some incredible stories from our role models in radiology who inspire us daily by consistently paving the way for more representation and inclusion in the field.
It is our hope that by putting a spotlight on these women, this podcast can transform into an act of mentorship in itself by being a forum for the hopes, dreams, failures, and achievements of all women with a passion for radiology, from young, aspiring radiologists to pioneers who are already working to shape the field.
Today, we will be speaking with Dr. Amy Patel, the medical director of the Women's Imaging Center at Liberty Hospital and assistant professor of radiology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Medicine.
Dr. Patel is a graduate of the combined BA-MD accelerated program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She completed her diagnostic radiology residency at the University of Kansas, Wichita, where she served as the first female chief resident in an all-male program. She completed her breast imaging fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis.
Her professional interests include recruitment of women in radiology and radiology political advocacy. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Patel, for joining us on this episode. We're so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, where did you grow up and go to school?
Sure. So I actually grew up in rural Northwest Missouri. So I grew up in a small town called Chillicothe of about 8,000 people. And then I was fortunate to get into the accelerated BAMD medical school program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Medicine. So I entered that program right out of high school. And then after I graduated from that program, I ended up going into radiology. So I did my intern year in internal medicine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Ended up doing my diagnostic radiology residency at the University of Kansas in Wichita, Kansas. They have two branches. I did my training at the Wichita branch, and then I did my breast imaging fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis, and then I ended up initially starting my career out at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. And I was on faculty at Harvard, teaching residents, fellows, medical students. And then, as luck would have it, in 2018, I had an opportunity to return back to Missouri to take over the breast center at Liberty Hospital, which is in the North Kansas City area. So I came back to lead the breast center and also am now an assistant professor of radiology back at my alma mater at UMKC, where I'm active in the residency program and at the School of Medicine. So sort of started in Missouri, left for the East Coast, and then returned back to Missouri.
Why did you decide to pursue radiology? And then what led you towards breast imaging?
Well, you know, I think for me, it was kind of a unique situation because I knew I wanted to do breast imaging quite early on. So my second to last year of medical school, I did a breast imaging elective. And that's kind of rare in medical school because, you know, people often ask me, how did you even know how to do a breast radiology elective? Well, one of my best friend's moms was a breast radiologist, and he suggested that maybe I should spend a month with her because I might like it. My initial plans were I was going to do primary care with an emphasis on women's health and go back to my hometown to practice. But once I did this elective, I sort of fell in love, and that was it. one of the big things is I've always been passionate about women's health, and breast imaging had that for me. And then in addition, the world of radiology, you know, from being able to interpret images at the workstation. For breast imaging, we have interpretation of mammograms, breast MRI, breast ultrasound, to just name a few. And then, you know, I really like doing procedures and working with my hands. And so I really like doing breast biopsies, and that was really appealing to me. And then breast radiology is one of those subspecialties in radiology where you have a lot of patient interaction, and I love interacting with patients. So for me, it sort of had the best of every world. And to take it even further beyond my clinical day-to-day, I have an avid interest in political advocacy and advocacy in general for patients. And breast imaging is a great profession where you can actually go out into the community and advocate for your patients for breast cancer screening and access to clinical trials. So it's been a wonderful career choice for me so far, and I'm just very passionate and I really love what I do.
That's so cool that you're involved in political advocacy. Could you tell us a little bit more about what that involves?
Sure. So I actually got interested in political advocacy as a radiology resident. So I was really fortunate to be the recipient of the American College of Radiology Rutherford Levante Government Relations Fellowship, which is a one-week fellowship in Washington, D.C., where you work with the ACR government relations team, you meet a lot of elected members of Congress, you attend a lot of events, and you really understand what our professions do on behalf of our patients, physicians, etc., to really ensure that our patients have access to, for example, in my field, the radiologic care that they need and that standard of care that they deserve, not just, you know, in certain parts of the country, but all over the country. So that's where I got interested in political advocacy. And from there, that really blossomed. And to the point now that I'm very blessed and I've been honored to be involved in the passing of critical breast imaging legislation in Missouri. So in 2018, I was involved in passing legislation which would ensure that women receive annual screening mammography beginning at age 40 who were average risk, and also have coverage for 3D mammography or digital breast tomosynthesis. And then just recently, I was fortunate to be involved in legislation that passed, that was actually signed into law by the governor in August of 2020 for women who are above average risk or high risk, meaning they have a 20% or greater lifetime percent risk of breast cancer, and ensuring that those women get the in coverage they need for more heightened surveillance in accordance with the American College of Radiology recommendations in above average risk women. So I've been really fortunate to be involved in legislation at the state level. When I practiced in Massachusetts, I was involved with working on legislation there as well. So for me, you know, I feel like if I, you know, I'm in this position where I can give a voice to patients who don't have one, and I have the tools and the knowledge to work with elected officials, particularly on the science side, the testimony, the testifying side. I testify on behalf of these patients, this legislation. If I have, you know, the ability to do that, I will continue to do it. So for me, I think that advocacy is just as important in my career as the clinical day-to-day.
That is so cool. Congratulations on getting that passed. I feel like that's such a unique side of medicine that we don't really get that much exposure to in medical school.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think that what's kind of a shame is that I wish that medical students were getting more exposure to this. And, you know, I think it, particularly where I am at UMKC, we're really trying to figure out ways to educate trainees and students earlier, because arguably the branch of political advocacy and advocating for your patients to receive the standard of care, that whole niche is just as important, you will find, as the clinical day-to-day that you learn in training and then when you're in clinical practice. So it just comes hand in hand. And I really believe that we need to do a better job at the medical school level to educate our students on this subject.
I absolutely agree, and I'm really hoping that Wired will be able to start that conversation. I have a question for you, Dr. Patel. You've been so successful. Did you ever experience failure or self-doubt in your journey? And if so, how did you overcome it?
Absolutely. I would be lying if I said, oh, it's been a, you know, better roses since day one. I will honestly say that my first semester I was at UMKC, it was quite a challenge. You know, I came from, like I said, a rural town. You know, I received as best of education as I could, but, you know, I found myself very early on struggling in comparison to my peers who might have gone to high school in a more urban setting, private schools, where they might have access to higher level learning. So I struggled in the beginning, and I had to get a tutor. And, you know, for someone who, and this happens to a lot of students, you know, you barely study in high school, and, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, and you just don't really understand what it means to actually how to study, and, you know, how to really absorb key concepts and things like that. So that was, you know, something for me that I really had to overcome, was particularly, you know, those first couple semesters, really trying to get my feet wet, gather my bearings, because it was, you know, it was difficult. You know, my first few exams I didn't do too well on. And, you know, I remember an anatomy test, I just did not do well. And I was just shocked. I'm like, I've never done this poorly before. So it was quite a wake-up call. But luckily, I was able to turn it around. But that, you know, the UMKC Medical Accelerated Program is very intense. Oftentimes, you're taking 22 hours a semester your first 2 years. So a lot of students, you know, can feel quite overwhelmed, which can lead to burnout and all these factors. So it's an intense program. So, you know, I struggled. But, you know, like I said, I sought support. Luckily, we do have support available regardless of what institution you're at. It's important to have that conversation going with your advisors, with your faculty mentors. And if you feel like you are struggling, you know, don't be afraid to seek help. I think sometimes we as students are so competitive and we view seeking help as a sign of weakness. But really, to me, it's a sign of strength that you can acknowledge that I need help to get through a difficult time. And as a result, because I sought that help, I was able to turn it around fairly quickly. And then I sort of never looked back.
Who are some people who have helped you and inspired you in your professional journey?
Yes. So particularly, you know, in the field of radiology, we have some really prolific figures. And one person that's a beloved mentor of mine, her name is Dr. Geraldine McGinty, and she is a breast radiologist at Cornell in New York. And she sort of took me under her wing when I was a first-year radiology resident. And, you know, here I am in Kansas, she's in New York, and we meet at an American College of Radiology annual meeting, and we sort of hit it off. And she's sort of been a great mentor and guiding light in my career ever since. She is so prolific in her own right. She's the first chair of the Board of Chancellors of the ACR, the first female chair in its 94-year history. She's just, you know, she has broken so many barriers in the field of radiology that's inspired so many of us women. She is leading initiatives in health equity for our patients, for the field of radiology, to promote diversity and inclusion. So she's been really transformative in that sense. So she is definitely an inspiration to me. But then, you know, I have others like my grandfather, who is now passed, and he was a surgeon, and he was a missionary surgeon, and he would work in really remote areas of Tanzania, Africa, serving patients. You know, patients at the time where there were no cures and of really deadly diseases, and just really made a life of service, and oftentimes, you know, put these patients ahead of even his own family. But as a result, he was sort of an inspiration to many of my cousins and I, and a lot of us are physicians as a result. So these are just two very prolific figures in my life that have really helped guide me throughout my career thus far.
It's really special to hear you reflect on these people who have helped shape your career. Looking back, what are some things that you would tell your younger self?
You know, I would tell my younger self that it's okay to take breaks and it's okay to let loose a little. I think that, you know, when I was in this accelerated program at UMKC as a medical student, I was constantly fixated on, I've got to be studying. And when I wasn't studying, I felt insanely guilty about it. And looking back, you know, I wish I would have probably taken more breaks. I wish I would have done more leisurely activities, because you get to a point when you're studying, which you two may kind of know about, you get to a point where you're just not able to absorb any more material. So then at that point, trying to study is sort of a waste of time and a fruitless endeavor. You know, I wish I would have known that a little bit earlier, thinking, oh, if I sit here, I don't know if I thought by like osmosis or something, I would just absorb extra information. But so, you know, it's a lesson learned. And whenever, you know, I'm blessed to have a lot of mentees and I tell them, you know, you've got to make time for yourself. You've got to take breaks. You've got to have regular exercise. Do the things you love. Don't relinquish the things you love. That's something important that I stress to my medical students, my residents. You know, you've got to make time for those special things in your life.
What are some of your hobbies and ways that you take care of yourself?
Yes. So, well, before the pandemic, I like to travel a lot. You know, whether it's in the United States or out of the United States, I love to travel and immerse myself in different cultures and ways of life. And so traveling is just a great way for me to unwind. I like to exercise. I like to play tennis and golf. You know, I really enjoy, actually, if I didn't go into medical school, I would have been a vocal music major. So I sing. So wow. I take voice lessons from a lady who actually I took lessons from as a medical student when she was on faculty at the conservatory. Now she's retired, but I go to her house and I take voice lessons. Obviously not right now because of the pandemic, but before, you know, I resumed those lessons and it's just been so wonderful to have that outlet. And then, of course, you know, I like to spend quality time with my fiance. We do a lot of documentary watching, movie watching. So those are some of the favorite things that I like to do.
It seems like you've molded your career and your life to fit your interests and things that you're passionate about. Could you describe a typical day for you and how you've adapted your career to work for your lifestyle?
Sure. So it will vary a little bit day to day, but typically my day starts around 8 o'clock, clinical day, unless I have some early morning meeting. I am chair of our cancer committee at our hospital, so I oversee all the cancer programs. So sometimes we will have a meeting before work that I have to lead. Then, you know, my clinical day starts around 8 o'clock. Typically goes till around 4. Obviously, today was a little bit busier, so it went beyond 4, where I have a mix of interpreting screening mammograms, diagnostic evaluations where a patient might be feeling a lump or some pain or is getting called back for a finding on a screening mammogram. I do image-guided biopsies, ultrasound, MRI, mammography or stereotactic corneal biopsies, you know, and also on the days the surgeons operate, I might have to localize a breast cancer or a high-risk lesion for them for them to be able to take this area out. So it's sort of a mixed bag of clinical work. But then in addition, I may have a commitment to, you know, speak on a radio show or to, you know, I might have another meeting with some nonprofit organization that is partnering with our breast program. So it's sort of a mixed bag of clinical and administrative duties and also a little bit of media mixed in. I really like, you know, being on podcasts, and I like to do radio shows, TV, anything I can, in particular when it comes to educating patients about their breast health. And then, of course, I love to, you know, mentor the future generation of medicine.
Yeah, we love your website. Or do you have like an interest in graphic design or something? Because it's like next level adorable.
Thank you. So I did not do that. I'm not going to take credit. I have a really amazing team of women who actually worked with me to design this website. From my color palette to my the symbols on the website to working on where I wanted the content, what I was trying to convey to the public. Because really, you know, for me, the website was important for, you know, of course, patients and stakeholders to get to know me, but really it is about educating patients and empowering them about their breast health. So I was so, elated that we launched the website in October, hope to build on the website, you know, in the form of a newsletter periodically. I'd like to get a regular podcast going, but the website really is the foundation, and I am just very pleased how it turned out.
That's incredible. Well, speaking of women, I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on the gender gap in radiology, and did this affect your decision to pursue it?
Well, honestly, I did not realize the disparity until I became a resident. I did not realize when I applied for radiology, I knew that it was a male-dominated field, but I did not realize how much of a male-dominated field it actually was until I got into residency. So in my class, I was the only female resident. By the time I became chief resident, I was in an all-male program, and I was the first female chief resident in an all-male program at my institution. And, you know, just learning about how, unfortunately, about 29% of radiologists right now in the field are women and the majority are men, you know, we have a lot of work to do. But I think it's really important to know that there are initiatives that are happening to try to get that number, flipped. And, one of the big things that I was actively involved in as a resident is I was really fortunate to establish the American College of Radiology Women in Diversity Resident and Fellow Section Committee. And so we started this committee for Women in Diversity. It was the Resident and Fellow Section branch of the main commission for Women in Diversity for ACR. And I was able to establish that in 2015. And it's really blossomed since then. And to shine a light on disparities, not just in women in radiology, but underrepresented minorities. We're making a lot of great strides. And obviously, when you're working on these types of initiatives, it takes time for progress. But I think that slowly but surely, we will see progress in the field because we are making such an active effort now to recruit women and underrepresented minorities in the field, to debunk stereotypes, and to really convey to medical students how amazing of a profession radiology really is.
Being the only female in your program, did you ever receive comments like you have opportunities because you're female and they're just trying to increase diversity? And how did you ever respond to those comments?
Well, I never really got it in that sense. I mean, I did have some comments at times saying like, you're being favored because you're a woman or something like that. Didn't happen very often, thankfully, because our program was very egalitarian in that manner, very supported. You know, when I became chief resident, it was an elected position, so I was elected by my peers who voted. So it was a fair election. I'm very proud that it wasn't just an appointment by my program director or some other faculty. You know, to me, I felt like I had earned that position. But, you know, I know that some of my friends had experienced that kind of thing in residency. And, you know, it's really unfortunate because, and, you know, arguably, I think that if a woman, particularly in a male-dominated specialty or vocation, is practicing, they have to, unfortunately, sometimes work twice as hard to get the same recognition as a man. And this doesn't just go for medicine. This goes for, like I said, other vocations. So I think that a lot of us women in the field, we work very, very, very hard, not to discredit our male colleagues because they are incredible. I'm fortunate to have really prolific male mentors as well that have lifted me up throughout my career. But I do think that there are instances where women have to work harder, and that is just a fact. Would it be wonderful to get to a day where that isn't the case? Yes. But until then, you know, we'll continue to fight on and hopefully achieve the recognition that we deserve.
Do you think there is ever a toxic competition between women?
Yes, I do think that is, I see that sometimes where I wish, you know, we as women sort of lifted each other up. I do think that, you know, particularly in radiology, we have such a wonderful Women in Radiology network. And I do feel that on the whole, we do lift each other up. But, you know, I think there are some instances that might go against that grain or some of my other colleagues in other medical specialties. But I think that's not just, you know, maybe akin to medicine, but other, you know, vocations as well. But, you know, it still most certainly exists. I would like to call it healthy competition. You know, it just pushes each other to be better, you know, the best version of themselves. But it definitely still exists.
How do we move more women into leadership roles?
Well, I think identifying talent is one thing. I think that sometimes maybe women don't see in themselves what others see in them. And the reason why I say that is because I think I'm a shining example. I think if I didn't have mentors who saw something in me that I didn't see, I wouldn't be where I am at this point in my career. And that's not just, you know, talking about Dr. McGinty, but I have other male mentors from my residency program, like my program director, Cameron Ali, one of my faculty in residency, John Lonis. I mean, these are people in my life that, particularly male mentors, who really saw something in me early and then really worked on cultivating my skills. So I think we as mentors really need to make a concerted effort to identify talent. And once we've identified that talent, really support them and cultivate their skills. On the flip side, if there are mentees who are seeking mentors, I think we as mentors need to be willing and able to support these mentees. It is a time commitment, no doubt. But, you know, it can pay extreme dividends if we're able to lift these mentees up for pipeline creation and for diversity at the highest levels, not just, you know, gender, but, you know, race. So there's so many benefits in terms of cultivating future leaders. But I think it's a two-way street in terms of cultivating the skills that they need to be truly successful.
I feel like that really resonates with us, especially as medical students, just the value of mentorship. It's so inspiring when someone else believes in you, because it's hard to see that in yourself sometimes.
100%. Yeah. I mean, there are times now, like even in my leadership positions, you know, I am still relatively early in my career, and at times, you know, you feel defeated, you know, if you propose something to the hospital leadership and it doesn't turn out the way you wanted. But that's when you really rely on your mentors to sort of lift you up, say, you know, dust yourself off, tomorrow's another day, you know, we believe in you, and that can make all the difference.
What are some goals you're currently working towards?
Yeah, so I mean, one goal is, I guess, my personal goal. I'm getting married, so that's kind of exciting.
Congrats.
Yeah, so I was supposed to get married last October, but because of the pandemic, we ended up pushing the wedding. So I'm just really excited from a personal standpoint to sort of, you know, quote unquote, get started with my life, you know, so to speak, and get married.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited and found, you know, really wonderful man. And hopefully, you know, another personal goal I have is I hope that we are able to have children one day. And that would be so rewarding, I think, for me to be a mother. So, you know, those are things that I strive for, you know, personally. And then, you know, how does that, you know, equate to balancing with my professional life? You know, our breast program at Liberty Hospital is still relatively young. We are expanding at a pretty rapid rate. And I'm so blessed that we are opening a new breast center because we have just grown so quickly. We're recruiting another breast imaging specialist. I mean, our breast program is really blossoming. So, you know, I have goals to continue with our breast program to be able to provide so many avenues of subspecialized breast care to our patients in the area. Because we serve not only Kansas City patients, but we serve Northwest Missouri all the way up to the Southern Iowa border. So I'm really working hard to sort of continue to build on our efforts to serve as many patients as we can.
Pertaining to the advancement of women, if you had one wish, what would it be?
That's a good question. I think my wish would be that, again, kind of what I talked about previously, that we have mentors regardless of career level, gender, practice type, that they really make an earnest effort for cultivating the skills of our future. If our, you know, regardless of what specialty you pursue, you know, our future and the success of our future is dependent on our future trainees. And I truly believe that. I feel that healthcare is rapidly changing, and we have to equip the future with the tools to succeed. And it will only make our profession that much brighter, regardless of subspecialty. So, you know, I would wish that, you know, to advance our leaders, our women leaders, male leaders, that we have mentors who are willing to step up to work with, like I said, identifying talent, working with the future to fortify the future so that it's a great success for all.
Do you have any advice for any of our listeners who are seeking mentorship just in the medical field or for those interested in radiology?
Sure. I would say that it's great to have mentors at your institution and really try to make an active effort to garner mentors at your institution. However, I think that having mentors outside of your institution is just as important. One really great way to seek mentors outside of your institution is actually social media. So I'm really big into social media. I believe in the power of it, particularly healthcare social media, medical education. There's a very robust radiology Twitterverse, and many of us are on Twitter in particular. And so I have developed a lot of mentor-mentee relationships just through Twitter alone. A student that follows me, I follow them back, they DM me, we end up having a Zoom call, and then it just sort of proliferates from there. End up meeting them, you know, and then I get to the point where I meet some of them like at main radiology meetings, and it feels like I already know them because I've already connected with them by virtual means. So I think that social media has been sort of the great equalizer when it comes to mentorship and sponsorship. So that would be, you know, a great way to sort of seek mentors and really diversify what I like to call your cadre of mentors.
We totally agree with you on the power of social media for mentorship. One of the events that we had through Wired was called Presence, and we essentially provided all of our attendees with all the tools that they would need to create their own Med Twitter, along with tips for getting started. Do you think that platforms like Twitter are important for medical students beyond just the aspect of networking?
So I don't necessarily think that if you don't have a digital presence at all, you won't, for example, match for residency or secure the fellowship of your choice, etc. But I do think that the medical education Twitterverse is really picked up a lot of steam in a very short amount of time, and that having an active presence can really elevate your profile. So particularly this year with the pandemic, those students who actually had a very active presence on Twitter, I think it was to their benefit because, you know, we already knew these faces, we knew these names. You know, there's a lot of program directors now on Twitter. And so they're able to sort of identify certain applicants and say, oh yeah, I've interacted with that person on Twitter, or I've seen their, you know, they have a strong social media presence. They're really involved in the radiology Twitterverse. I mean, I think that really gives those applicants a leg up because they have that active outwardly presence. I was fortunate enough to be a part of a manuscript recently in the Journal of the American College of Radiology that makes the case of why medical students should have an active presence on Twitter. And we talk about these things and why, you know, it can be important and sort of give you that sort of leg up in comparison to your peers. So I am a true believer that students, trainees should be on social media, particularly Twitter, because the medical education Twitterverse is just really growing at such a rapid pace.
You know, just speaking like with some other medical students, I feel like the hesitation or the nervousness that's associated with making an online Twitter or like an Instagram is that we feel like we may not have as much to contribute content-wise. Do you have any tips for how students can just be genuine online? Or, I mean, just being blunt here, do you think it's like cringy if we comment on like radiology things, if, you know, our knowledge may be limited?
And also, how can we become more informed?
Yeah. So I think being a part of the discussion is important, and any question you have is not a stupid one. So if you see some, you know, for example, let's say you want to go into radiology and you see some, you know, well-known radiologist that shared an article and you want to learn more about it, or you read it and you have a question about it, you know, it's perfectly fine. And I encourage you to engage with that radiologist because they're there for a reason and they're happy to interact with you. Sharing content in regards to things that you are interested in, particularly in the field that you're interested in, can be a great way to be a part of the discussion. Tag others, you know, what do they think about that? Particularly, you know, maybe an article that could spur some robust discussion. And, you know, as simple as like initiatives and things that you do at your home institution that you feel passionately about and sharing about that, I think that is also a really fantastic way to engage in this social media universe, whether you're on Insta or you're on Twitter. You know, I'm fortunate to be a faculty advisor of our UMKC School of Medicine chapter of the American Medical Women's Association. And, you know, we had a board meeting not too long ago. We took a screen capture image, when we were on our Zoom meeting, and, you know, we shared that, you know, that we got together. And, you know, so initiatives like that are just amazing and bring people together. And, you know, you'd be surprised how it spurs interest. You see like, oh, they're doing that at, you know, at that institution, you know, why can't we do the same thing at ours? So you would be surprised how content that you might think really isn't going to make an impact ends up resulting in sort of the antithesis of that.
Dr. Patel, we appreciate your enthusiasm so much. Do you mind sharing some of your information so any of our listeners can look you up online and continue to be inspired by you?
Absolutely. So I have that website like we talked about, and the website is Dr. amykpatel.com. So it's all one word, dramykpatel.com. And then from there, if you want to get a hold of me, there's a way to contact me on that website. And then my Twitter handle and my Instagram handles, I tend to be more active on those platforms. They're just at Amy K. Patel, so easy to remember. And so, yeah, if you, you know, follow me on Twitter, I will follow you back. I'll give you a shout out. You know, anything you need, I am here and I'm happy to help.
Thank you so much for coming on our podcast and for speaking with us and sharing your story with our listeners. We're so excited to have you on. And just really appreciate you taking the time.
Of course. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of the Wired Podcast. We hope this story opened your eyes to a new role model, piqued your interest in a new career trajectory, or exposed you to the fact that failure and struggle are normal hurdles, even in the paths of the greatest women. Feel free to connect with us on Instagram at @wired.uab or on Twitter at @wired_UAB. See you next time.
This podcast would not have been possible without the mentorship we received by our faculty mentor, Dr. Desmond Milner, and resident advisors, Dr. Kathy Chin, Dr. Mary Beth Oglesby, and Dr. Adrian Murray.